We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Bob Moriarty, founder of 321 Gold and 321 Energy. He was also a Marine Corps fighter pilot in Vietnam. Bob, thanks for joining me today.
It's always a pleasure to see you again, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. You know, just getting through the summer here, enjoying some nice weather before it turns cold again. How's life?
Right. It's summertime in Canada. Let's see. It's the 25th, so we've got summertime from 2 days ago until 2 days from now. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's a definite possibility. I mean, we've definitely seen snow in August here sometimes.
I've flown through Gander about 150 times, and I've seen snow in July and August in Gander. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's way on the other side of the country from where I am, but I totally believe it. So, Bob, maybe we could start by talking about what the real story is about the protests in France. You know, you obviously live there. And you brought up something to me earlier, this idea of boots on the ground experience, which, you know, I think you have a lot of. And that's, you know, a lot of kind of what I want to focus our conversation around today. So what do you think is the real story of the protests in France right now versus the narrative that's being presented?
Well, first of all, 100% of the narrative that we're being fed on a constant basis, if you want to know the truth, it is the opposite of the narrative. That was true of COVID. It's true of Ukraine. It was true of Iraq. It was true of Iran. It was true of Afghanistan. And it's certainly true of the riots. As I understand it, there was a young man. He was North African, I believe, who tried to evade a police stop, and he was shot. And it's one of those situations. Here's the real issue. The EU has taken this position that unlimited immigration is a good idea. And it's not immigration nearly as much as it is unlimited invasion. And what you're getting is a lot of military age young men. You're not getting families, and you're not getting people who want to integrate into the society. I was on a trip recently with a newsletter writer from Sweden, and he said the immigration policy is literally destroying Sweden as a country, and I believe that. And what I think happened was you got all these people from the Middle East and from Africa who were told stories about you can come to the EU and they will give you unlimited cornucopia benefits and money and shelter. And then when the sanctions were put in place, all of a sudden inflation went up to 15-25%. They didn't get their free lunch anymore and they were upset. At the same time there were riots in France, there were riots in Brussels and in Switzerland. And there is an uneasiness, literally in the entire world, where everyone recognizes something is wrong and no one has a real solution to it. And frankly, I believe, and it's just my opinion, that it all goes back to having dishonest money. When you've got dishonest money, you get a dishonest financial system. You should be able to work. You should get benefits from the work. You should make money. You should have the ability to save money. And the policies of governments around the world are destroying the middle class. Every society has rich people. And you'll never change that. And every society has poor people, and you're never going to change that. And the only variable is the percentage of the society that is middle class. And as much as I love France, I think the government is run by idiots, and they're destroying the middle class. When you destroy the middle class, you destroy the stability of the country, and you have a lot of people that are quite angry. And many years ago, I wrote a book in 2016, and on the last page of the book, I predicted the world's first worldwide revolution. And I think it has started. I think it'll get considerably worse until we go back to some kind of honest money and an honest financial system.
Well, Bob, you know, as you're talking about revolution, you know, obviously the French seem to be very, you know, into protesting. They seem from the outside to be very willing to express their discontent. In your experience, are they, let's say, more sensitive and willing to protest or revolt over politics than much of the rest of the West?
Yes, I think so. I'm actually disappointed in Americans because there is so much wrong in America, and you just wonder why someone doesn't protest. And I'm going to say something nice about Canada. The Canadian truck drivers were the bravest people I ever have seen. It was not organized. There was not a central group running this. Somebody didn't say, hey, I've got an idea, let's go do this. A lot of people realized at exactly the same time that the policies of the Canadian government were wrong and they needed to do something about it. And strange enough, the reaction of the government and the Trudeau administration proved who the good guys were and who the bad guys were. They clamped down. They stole people's money from their bank accounts. They lied about everything that was happening. But the Canadian truck drivers had more impact on the Canadian government than anything in the last probably 100 years. And I would like to see more protests like that. And I certainly would like to see it in the United States. We have the most corrupt president in American history, and nobody's protesting.
Well, you know, that's kind of another one of the roads I wanted to go down with you, was asking you if more people should be protesting the war in Ukraine and the bottomless pit of money being sent there and the supposed outcomes of that conflict at this point.
Well, the narrative is 100% incorrect. I wrote an article on March 1st of 2022, and I said that sanctions were suicide for the EU, for the dollar, for NATO, and the United States. And I absolutely stand by that. The sanctions were the dumbest thing I've ever seen governments do. Now, perhaps it made sense for the United States to think, well, we can destroy Russia, okay, just by yanking the rug right out from underneath them. That's a great theory. In practice, it didn't work. But why did the Germans put up with the United States blowing up Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2? And I was in the military, and I'm going to tell you, 100% the United States did it, and I could prove it rationally. Would you like me to prove the United States blew up Nord Stream?
Sure.
How many pipelines were there?
4.
How many were blown up?
3.
Okay. How competent were the people who blew up 3 of the 4 pipelines?
I think you could make an argument either way, because I don't think that getting to where those pipelines are is an easy task.
But I think it's the easiest task in the world. They put the damn pipelines down in the first place. You could certainly go down there. There was a U.S. aircraft carrier, the USS Kearsarge, who was floating over that area for days in advance of that. They not only did the United States do it, and I can prove it, anybody that's incompetent enough spend $2.3 trillion fighting 20 years in Afghanistan, where the occupation of your opponent were either sheep herders or goat herders, and the sheep herders and the goat herders kick your ass, you are incompetent. You have no business fighting wars because you were led by idiots, and only idiots attack four pipelines and destroy three. Because what was the purpose of destroying the pipeline?
To kind of back Europe into a corner and take away that ability, that bargaining piece, which is the energy that the rest of Europe needed.
Exactly. Did it succeed?
I think they got lucky last year.
No. Well, strange enough, that's a totally different issue. Mm-hmm. But did they succeed in removing the alternative where Germany says, okay, Russia, we thought about it. We don't want to shut our industry down. So go ahead and turn the gas back on. How much are you going to charge us? Mm-hmm. They wanted to destroy all four pipes because they wanted to remove the ability of Germany to make that decision. And they failed. And the crazy thing is, it doesn't make any difference whether they knocked out three, as long as they left the alternative to Germany to wake up and smell the roses. And you know, why the EU committed suicide financially and is in the process of deindustrializing right now is utterly irrational. You just raised a good point. And I don't think anybody's discussed this. Okay, in relative terms, in the last 50 years, how mild was the winter in Europe?
Not 100% sure, Bob.
It's one of the mildest winter. I would guess, without doing any research, it would be one of the top one or two mm-hmm. out of the last 50 years. It was an exceptionally mild winter. Now, what does that mean? A UN organization did a study, and they concluded due to the increased prices of natural gas and fossil fuel for heating, that 30,000 people would die in a mild winter, and 300,000 people would die in a cold winter. Now, typically, when you have a mild winter, what happens the next year?
Probably goes back, adjusts to the mean, or let's say weighs out the other side of that average.
Exactly. Okay. You swing both sides of the mean. So when you have an exceptionally mild winter, the next winter will tend to be excessively cold. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a perfect example. Barbara and I bought a tiny farm here. The ground is wonderful. You can grow anything. And I put in 500 grape plants. The wine from last year was absolutely exceptional. It was really good wine. So I went over to take a look at the grapes a couple of days ago. And we had so much moisture in the last 2 or 3 months that literally my plants couldn't make 2 or 3 bottles of wine. I would be picking grapes one at a time. And that's been true all the way from the Spanish border to Bordeaux. There have been hundreds of millions or billions of dollars lost. This year's grape crop in the south of France has been destroyed. Last year was great. This year was terrible. And that's the way nature tends to work. So I would be exceptionally apprehensive about what this winter is going to bring for Europe. I think it's going to be worse. And I think the energy crisis is going to be far worse this year than it was last year. And quite bluntly, it's not anything the United States did. is something that the EU did to itself, which is plain stupid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what the weather brings them this year, and if they hopefully learned any of the lessons from last year.
The lesson would be, you know, we were stupid last year. We left the Americans. That was a $30 billion act of terrorism. It was the biggest act of terrorism in world history. The Swedes know who did it. The Danes know who did it. The Poles know who did it. The Russians know who did it. The Ukrainians know who did it. You know who the only people who don't know who did it?
The American people?
American people, thanks very much, because we don't ever tell them truth. Okay. And I've actually been in contact. I've talked to Seymour Hersh, and I think Seymour Hersh was given a bill of goods. Okay. Some of which was true and most of which was absolute rubbish. He was told that sometime 6 months ago, the Navy came in and put down special weapons next to the pipelines, and then a Norwegian P-8 flew over and gave a special signal and told the torpedoes or the mines, as it were, to blow up. Wait a minute. Why would they use the Norwegian P-8? Why would you involve another country when you didn't need to? We got P-8s in the United States, and in fact, there was a U.S. Navy P-8 that flew nonstop from the United States, did aerial refueling over Poland, flew over the area where the pipeline blew up, and then flew back to the United States nonstop. So why would they say it was the Norwegians, where clearly it was the Americans? And what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, well, we may have been involved, okay, but so were the Norwegians, and so were the Poles, and so were the Danes, and so were the Swedes. Bullshit. The United States is running this war, okay? They make all the decisions. They let the Ukrainians die, but, you know, that's okay. Lots of Ukrainians. But there's other issues, like there have been 7 to 9 million Ukrainians who have left Ukraine because of the war. And quite bluntly, the EU cannot absorb that many people and provide them an income and shelter and food and money. So the war has been especially stupid. I'm exceptionally anti-war. There's no such thing as a good war. It's been a stupid war, and it continues every day because the United States and the neocons want it to continue, and that's criminal.
So, Bob, how worried are you about more escalation, you know, due to this conflict? You mentioned to me that there's a situation now developing in Cuba again.
Well, there's a situation in Cuba and also a situation in Poland. When I was in Vietnam, I was an F-4 pilot for about 4 months, and I flew 125 missions, and then I was a bird dog pilot. One of the things I never talked to anybody about, I actually worked, we worked with the CIA, because they sent SOG teams over into Laos, and we provided air support to these guys. I've worked with CIA enough that I understand how the CIA works, and how they think, how they hire people. And the CIA has a bunch of guys who are in the military and retired from the military, and then they go to work for the CIA so they can collect another retirement. And they don't know how to win a war, okay? And they come up with these chicken shit little operations that are irritating, but don't have anything to do with winning a war, okay? So you blow a truckload of munitions up and you collapse part of the bridge for a short period of time. What effect does that have on the war? None. you send a bunch of drones into Crimea. What effect does that have on the war? None. You send a bunch of sea drones into Crimea and try to attack Sevastopol. All of these things are chicken shit little attacks that have nothing to do with winning a war. If you're going to win a war, you have to have some kind of strategy. You have to have some kind of plan. And quite bluntly, the CIA has never won a war. They've got a bunch of idiots coming up, sitting around a table, smoking cigarettes, saying, hey, I've got an idea. And there is nothing more dangerous than a Army or Marine or Navy colonel sitting around saying, hey, I've got an idea. Well, you know, it didn't work the last 50 times. Why is it going to work this time? My nephew was one of three Special Forces people killed in Jordan in 2016, November 4th of 2016, because the CIA and the Special Forces is their army were training the terrorists that we were sending to Syria to overthrow the Assad government. And the terrorists went to the CIA and said, look, when Americans go into battle, they get air support and they get artillery support. We want the same thing. And the CIA said, fuck you. Okay, we're giving you ammunition. We're paying you, you know, go kill some Syrians, okay, and we'll all be happy. The King of Jordan set up the murder of those three Special Forces people, including my nephew. And they were murdered in cold blood by a sergeant major who happened to belong to the same tribe as Assad. And the fourth Special Forces guy managed to wound the sergeant major, and the sergeant major was in hospital for about 6 months. And then they put him in the brig, and then they tried it. Now, I happen to know that was set up by the King of Jordan for a very simple rational reason. While he was under arrest, he was promoted from sergeant major to become an officer. And you don't do that to somebody you're going to punish. You only do that to someone you want to reward. So We're told so much nonsense about so many things. We were supporting the terrorists in Syria. We weren't attacking them. We were the terrorists in Syria. We lost the war in Iraq. We lost the war in Syria. We lost the war in Afghanistan. We lost pretty much the war in Pakistan. I'm starting to see a pattern. And if I was that stupid, I would stop fighting wars, because every time you fight a war and you're that stupid, you lose and things get worse. Why the American people aren't protesting the $150 billion that have been dumped into the most corrupt country in Europe is simply beyond me. But the answer is, well, Joe Biden and Hunter Biden took $10 million in bribes from the president of Burisma, who happens to have 17 telephone calls, including two with Joe Biden talking about the bribe. And that's not front page news, because they don't want you to know that.
Bob, you know, earlier you mentioned that you don't think that we're going to get or be able to get any type of fix to any of this without a reset in the money. I want to get your take on, obviously, the BRICS countries moving to whatever structure of currency that they will be kind of announcing here in August. Do you think that is going to be a more or less consequential move for the world economy than the collapsing of the debt system in the West?
The debt system is going to collapse regardless of what the BRICS do. And I think what the BRICS are doing is in response, because they see this coming in advance. But the August 22nd meeting in Joburg, it's very interesting. South Africa said there absolutely is not a plan to go to a gold-backed currency. And the news about going to a gold-backed currency came out of, I think, Kenya. So I can't say whether it's real or not. In my opinion, BRICS will go to a resource-based financial system as opposed to a debt-based financial system. And they will go to gold if for no other reason it's the simplest way to do it. Now, do you know what caused the French Revolution?
I need to brush up on it.
The American Revolution. The French did not have to get involved in the American Revolution. It was entirely voluntary. And they were flipping the bird at the English, okay? But it ended up bankrupting Louis XVI, okay? So the American Revolution ended in 1783. By 1789, the peasants in Paris couldn't afford to buy wheat. And if that sounds familiar with what's going on in the United States, it's only because it is familiar. Okay, we have destroyed our currency, and that's just starting to show up. So between 1789, when the revolution started, and 1795 and 1796, they issued a currency called the mandat, and it failed. Okay, they were just printing currencies. I've actually got some of the currency on the wall. The first currency they issued was the assignat, and that failed. And then they went to the mandat, and that failed. And then in 1795, a French army colonel seized control, and he went back to gold and silver. And in fact, that was Napoleon, and he financed all of the wars that France got involved in, because after the revolution, it destroyed the economy of France, and all they had to do is go back to real money, and all of a sudden they were wealthy again. France should be one of the richest countries in Europe, because you can grow practically anything, practically anywhere. But they pretty much destroyed the middle class here. So that's a long answer to your question. But there are 40 countries trying to enter BRICS. There are 70 in total who have an interest in talking about it, including the French, okay? Macron went to them and said, hey, I want an invitation to the meeting. And they said, who are you? He said, no, okay, we're not going to do that. But I believe there will be a gold-backed currency, whether it's announced in August. I'm not sure that's true. I think everybody's lying about everything now, and it's really difficult to figure out who's telling the truth. I don't think the decision has been made to go to gold. I think that was a trial balloon, but I think at the end of the day, they will go to a gold-backed system just because it's the easiest decision to make.
Why do you think that they didn't give Macron an invite into the BRICS? Is it because they want leaders that are more aligned with actually working together?
Yeah, of course. Okay, Macron really works for the Rothschilds, okay? And it was a way of the Rothschilds protecting their wealth. There is a basic conflict that virtually no one is talking about except me, between the debt-based system of the West and the resource-based system of the East. and quite bluntly, you know, that $300 trillion in debt is not going to get paid. The I don't even know what the number is, 800 trillion or 2,000 trillion in derivatives. We've got a financial system that is broken, okay? There is no fixing it any more than there is fixing the FBI, okay? You can't fix the FBI. They're too corrupt. You can't fix the financial system. It's too corrupt. So we need to have it collapse. And I just kind of hope the financial system collapses before those idiots in Washington start World War III.
That's a terrible hope to have to make, Bob.
It's a better alternative because we can survive the crash of the financial system. That's happened thousands of times in the past. And I don't believe we can survive a nuclear war.
I agree. Bob, as we're kind of touching on the financial system, I want to get your take on sentiment. How do you, let's say, measure sentiment in the metals? And does that hold any weight to you? Do you base any decision off of that?
There are two types of information. There is signal and there is noise. Signal is something that has value that you could say, if this is true, then this is true. Noise is what it sounds like, noise. If you remember what radios used to sound like, you had both signal and you had noise. And of course, they've gotten rid of the noise. So radios are incredible today compared to what they used to be. Sentiment is simply the most valuable signal that you can possibly have with any investment. At every high in any commodity or any financial instrument, everybody's bullish, and there's 100 reasons to buy. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it a top. At every low, everyone hates that financial instrument, and there's 100 reasons to sell, and that's what makes it a bottom. If all you focus on is sentiment, you don't have to know anything about interest rates. You don't have to know anything about economics. You don't have to know anything about the media, about the Fed, about the war in Ukraine, because all of that is noise and not signal. Now, the problem is finding the most accurate signal. In March of 2000, when the NASDAQ had gone up 19 days in a row, prisoners in a Baltimore jail were holding stock picking contests. And that was in the newspaper. And I thought, okay, that's the best possible signal you could ever have. This is a market top right now. And I called it literally to the day. And I did the same thing with the price of gold and silver on January 21st of 1980, because I am spring-loaded to try to figure out sentiment. Now, there's a measure of sentiment that everyone has access to called the daily sentiment indicator. And I would highly advise people to look it up. And he measures 44 commodities, and he gives a signal based on the ratio of people buying and the ratio of people selling. Mm-hmm. And it's remarkably accurate. I called the top in silver to the day, I think it was April 27th of 2011. People were paying a 25% premium for the Sprott Silver ETF. So they effectively were paying $62.50 for $50 worth of silver. And I said, you know, if I went into a coin dealer and the guy told me he was going to charge me a 25% premium, I'd tell him to shove it where the sun doesn't shine. That's outrageous. But people were voluntarily paying 25% premium for the Sprott Silver ETF. And that was as clear a signal as I think you could possibly get. Now, all of the articles that I've ever written are still on the website and people can look this up. The strange thing is, when I make a prediction like that, like predicting silver's topping, I got hundreds of hate mail. And strange enough, all the hate mail told me that my measure of sentiment was correct, because these are all people who wanted to buy silver at $35 an ounce, $40 an ounce, $50 an ounce. And they didn't want anybody saying, oh, by the way, you're getting carried away. Mm-hmm. But sentiment right now is about as poor for resource stocks, especially gold and silver. It's not the worst I've ever seen. But given the financial chaos in the world, and given, you know, we're $40 away from a new high in gold, but the gold stocks don't reflect it. Nobody wants to own gold stocks. There's so many good deals out there today. We've got a near record high in the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ, yet commercial real estate's crashing. The banks are crashing. We've got this idiot president coming up with all kinds of stupid stuff. You know, we need to give people more free money. We got people talking about inflation as transitory. Inflation's about as transitory as syphilis.
That what we should call this episode, Bob?
That would be a good one. Once in a while, I actually come up with a good, cute line.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're mentioning the sentiment in the explorers and the mining space. You know, do we need a turn in, let's say, the stock markets to bring capital back into that space? Like, what do you think brings interest back into that space, Bob?
An extreme sentiment. Strange enough, and you're going back and you're trying to find a rational reason. I don't think there's any rational reason. I just want to measure sentiment. I don't care why the sentiment exists. Mm. I only care that it exists. And strange enough, the sentiment for gold and silver is mildly positive right now. Mm-hmm. And the sentiment for the stock market, the S&P and the NASDAQ, is getting very dangerous. My opinion is that we're going to see a top in the general stock market in early September, and we're going to have the same thing that we had in 1929. 1929, the stock market topped, I think, on September 5th. And then crashed into October, and then the depression started. The smartest guys I know all understand we're going to have the biggest crash in world history. And, you know, whether it's in September or October or a year from now, I don't know. I just know it's coming.
Bob, you know, exactly as we're talking about, you know, we mentioned the kind of summer doldrums, which is a topic that most gold bugs that have been in this a while understand, and even in the financial and the banking markets seems to be kind of relatively stagnant for the summer here. Do you see more of those issues cropping up from the high interest rates, like another banking crisis, or how do you see that next crisis presenting itself, if you have any idea?
There are 30,000 economists working for the Federal Reserve, and every single one of them gets it wrong. And they're about to raise interest rates again. If they don't do it this month, they'll do it next month. They're going to raise interest rates till the system blows up. That's bad. Mm-hmm. However, if they lower interest rates, they're voting for hyperinflation. So talking about the financial system is like discussing dying from a heart attack or dying from a stroke. I'm not sure it makes any difference. That the real issue is whether you die. Mm-hmm. The financial system is long past its prime. We have the most corrupt government in the United States and basically in the West. And it's time for a reset, and not a reset like Klaus Schwab wants, where he wants total control. We need to go back to honest money, and we need to reset the system, and we need to start building the middle class rather than destroying the middle class.
Mm-hmm. Bob, what attracts you to the miners and explorers so much versus other categories of investments? Is it the asymmetric nature of when that tide turns?
Nah, it's the percentage return. There was a stock, I can give you the name if you want, that somebody wanted to unload millions of shares, and the stock was 15 cents 6 weeks ago, and it was 5.5 cents 2 weeks ago. And at 6 cents, I said, this is utterly irrational. So I bought a bunch of shares, and it was 9 cents the next day. Now, it went as high, it's 10 and a half cents. When you invest in anything, you don't make money on the absolute return. You make money on the percentage return. And a 100% change in a 2 cent stock is the same thing as a 100% change in a $10 stock, and people forget that, and they think they want to invest in quality. Screw quality. Go for the percentage return. I know of no investment except perhaps leveraged commodities that offer the percentage return that the juniors offer. Mm-hmm. And quite bluntly, if I was 30 years old or 35 years old and knew about the daily sentiment indicator, I would do nothing but trade commodities, leverage commodities, because I worked for a guy that was filthy rich. Let me think about this. Almost 40 years ago in Miami, and I bought him sugar at 2.5 cents under the theory that, you know, sugar's got to be worth something. And sugar went from 2.5 cents to 12.5 cents, and it meant a $110,000 return on a $10,000 investment. You can do that in commodities if you can measure sentiment accurately, and you wait for either excessive optimism or excessive pessimism, mm-hmm. because it always turns. Mm-hmm.
Bob, you know, you've had a life so filled with adventure, and you've done so many different things. Are there any stories around, let's say, mining or exploration that you think our audience would enjoy hearing?
Well, I wrote a really great book. And of course, since I wrote the book, I could say that about Novo Resources and a giant gold find in Australia. Mm-hmm. They got into production and the COVID hit. And the gold's still there. The gold's been there for 150 years. Okay. No one has ever debated my thesis that it's the greatest gold mine in history. I'll tell you a quick story. It's something that very few people know. In 1976, the second richest guy in Australia was Lang Hancock. And Lang Hancock was the prospector who found the iron fields in the Pilbara and did a deal with, I think, Rio Tinto, that, you know, the guy was getting millions of dollars a year in royalties. And now his daughter is getting hundreds of millions or billions of dollars a year in royalty. So the guy that I was working for wanted me to pick this airplane up in Lakeland and take it to Australia. So I go down to Lakeland to pick up the airplane. He said, well, there's something I got to tell you. I said, what's that? And he said, well, I want you to take a co-pilot. I said, a co-pilot? But there's only one airplane. You know, given the choice between a co-pilot and a wet, soggy sandwich, I'll go for the wet, soggy sandwich anytime. Well, it's Lang Hancock's son-in-law. I don't care, okay? Why would I care who it is? He's a damn co-pilot. So he said, you don't have to take the airplane. Thank God. I didn't want to take that piece of crap airplane anyway. It had belonged to Wayne Newton, and it sat on the taxiway for years. I knew it was a problem airplane. He said, but of course, you don't have to take any airplanes until this airplane gets to Australia. I said, is that a threat? He said, no, that's not a threat. That's a promise. Oh, okay, I get it. Yeah, I'd love to take this airplane. So I took the airplane from Lakeland, Florida to Australia, Melbourne. And for 85 hours, Lang Hancock's son-in-law told me about how wonderful and how big and how rich the Pilbara iron ore fields were. It's the richest ore in the world, the biggest iron deposit in world history. And they were making money hand over fist. Now, that's the kind of story that's really, really interesting, and you want to listen to for about 3 minutes. When you get to the fourth minute, it gets really fucking boring. And he went on and on and on and on. And I kept hoping we were going to have some kind of emergency so I could get him to shut up. And then in 2009, I met Quentin Henny in 2008, and he told me his theory about how gold precipitated out of salt water in the presence of oxygen. I said, oh, that's an interesting theory. So in 2009, we went to the Pilbara, and we looked at these banded iron formations. And I said, well, how do those banded iron formations get there? And he said, well, you had iron in salt water, and it precipitated out of solution in the presence of oxygen, just like my theory about gold. And I said, no shit. That's interesting. It's a lot more interesting to listen to iron ore. So I said, would that happen about the same time with iron and gold? And he said, yeah, same cause, same time, everything. And I said, well, doesn't it make sense if you had the world's richest iron deposit? Doesn't it also make sense that you would have the world's biggest and richest gold deposit? And he said, yep. I said, okay, I'm on board. Well, all of that worked very well until COVID hit. And Quentin literally couldn't go to Australia. And the Australian government went full bore Nazi. You couldn't hire people. You couldn't bring people into the country. They couldn't move from one province to the other province. And it literally kills the mine once it actually went into production. There were a lot of screw-ups. I mean, I'll totally agree with that. But the book is easily the best book about coming up with a great idea to actually getting into production. And there's some people in the mining business who hate me because what I said about them in the book. But it's probably the best book. And it's a book that I think people will be reading 50 years from now. People have no idea of how difficult it is to actually go into production. The government makes it difficult for you. The rules and regulation makes it difficult for you. Your own employees make it difficult. Your competition makes it difficult. It's really, really difficult to get a mine into production and actually make a profit. In the junior mining business, 90% of the companies are going to fail. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you can't make money, because there's a good time to buy and there's a good time to sell, and you can make more money in a short time. I've never heard of anybody making a 100% return or a 50% return on a stock in one day, and I did it 2 weeks ago, and it's on a stock that had nothing in particular going for it other than sentiment.
So how were you able to measure sentiment in a stock like that?
Kentucky Windage.
or 74 years of experience.
Well, that's it right there. Strange enough, and this goes back to 1968 and 1969. When I was in Vietnam, we tracked every single expense. We knew what Jet A4 cost, we know what JP5 cost, we knew what sunglasses cost, we knew what 500-pound bombs cost, and we kept track of all that stuff. And I looked around, and I said, you know, other than the 10% income tax surcharge that Johnson put on, we're not paying for this war. And if we're not paying for this war, that's got to be bad for the dollar. I wonder what it would be good for. And I looked around, I thought, you know, maybe it would be good for gold, and maybe it would be good for silver. And I started buying gold and silver in 1968. And of course, it went up. Silver went from $1.29 to $50.25 an ounce. And gold went from $35 an ounce to $875. So there was just an incredible potential there, just based on looking around and saying, you know, nobody likes gold. Everybody likes the dollar. Maybe I like gold and maybe I hate the dollar. Mm-hmm. And we're in the same situation right now. The dollar's real popular and the stock market's real popular, but all things change in investing. And the next move is probably down, certainly down for the stock market. And I think the U.S. dollar is terminal. I don't think that's going to happen in a day or two or a month, but I think the bad decisions the government has made, it's terminal for the U.S. dollar. Mm-hmm. People are just waiting for an alternative.
Yeah, it seems like, again, the way that these tangible assets seem to measure the devaluation of these fiat currencies seems to be, you know, one of the most well-worn patterns that, if you look at it over time, seems to really tell the story.
Well, here's why. When you talk about the price of gold, how many commodities are you talking about?
Two or three?
No, you're talking about two. You're talking about gold, and you're talking about what you're measuring in, which is dollars. Mm. And to say gold has gone up is actually flawed logic. Gold hasn't gone up. Okay, an ounce of gold is worth the same thing as an ounce of gold was 50 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 1,000 years ago. What has changed is what you're measuring in. And it's the value of the dollar that's changed, not the value of the gold. And we forget that there's all kinds of things that we're told. They're logically irrational. Mm-hmm. Gold doesn't change its value. The dollar does.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bob, I think that's a decent place to wrap up for today, unless there's anything else that you have to add.
Did we mention the Nobel Prize winning?
No, we didn't.
Physicist. We should mention that. I believe that everything in the narrative we're told today is a lie. But you can look at this Nobel Prize winning physicist who came out with a comment a few days ago. He had been invited to speak to the IMF about climate change. And it came out a few days ago and he said, you know, I don't believe this climate change thing. I think it's nonsense. And what they have done is they have literally deplatformed him. Okay. They canceled the invitation. The IMF didn't want to hear that maybe climate change was fiction. Well, climate change is fiction. They made it up. It's absolute rubbish. They're lying about it. They know they're lying about it. And if you're a physicist and have a Nobel Prize, they're not going to listen to you.
So do you think that that is, you know, another symptom of just trying to control things, or was it a legitimate argument?
Well, no. Okay. Anytime I am faced with an issue, I want to know all of the potential facts that could affect it. I want to know as much about it as possible. Mm-hmm. I go out of my way to read people that I know are idiots because I want to understand their argument, because maybe they're not idiots. Maybe I'm the idiot. I want to see if my logic is valid and their logic is invalid. But it absolutely has to do with control. We don't want to hear anything that doesn't fit our narrative. But our narrative, since December of 2012, the United States has been in this massive propaganda war. The narrative about COVID was all fiction. The narrative about the Ukraine war is all fiction. Narrative about what's going on in Europe is all fiction. So literally, if you want to know what's going on, study the narrative very carefully and then understand 100% of it is a lie. We had a director of the CIA, I think in 1979, I could be wrong about the year, who said, we know that we're effective at the CIA, what 100% of what Americans believe is a lie. And we're there.
Well, strange times, Bob, and I appreciate you coming on to help us make sense of some of it, at least.
I hope so. And it certainly is interesting times, but I believe people are starting to wake up, and that's going to make a difference. And I would love to see protests in the United States. There's a lot of things to protest about.
Absolutely. All right, Bob. Of course, all of your articles, including the ones that you mentioned, are available at 321gold.com and also 321energy.com, right?
Yes, correct.
Wonderful. Thanks for your time today, Bob.
Okay, Tom. I appreciate it. You always do a good job.
Thank you, sir. You too.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.